Well, hello there, listeners. Thanks for letting me out of that bowling trophy. Uncle Ippy here, and I've got three wishes for you.
Can I use one of them to shut you up?
Listen to them. Children of the night. What music they make.
Oh my goodness.
I think the coronavirus finally made it to Richmond.
It did. It has claimed another victim. Her name, Alex.
R.I.P. Alex.
She's no longer with us. I know we've joked about this before, but this time we're serious.
Yeah.
Deadly serious.
Send her husband some Corona Light to make sure that he doesn't get it too.
Yeah.
Everybody, it's the only way to fight the... It's the true vaccine.
Listeners, please send all Corona Light that you have over to... What's Alex's address?
I don't actually know.
Do I?
I don't need to know. She's in walking distance.
Well, I guess she's going to die.
I think she's already dead.
Uh-oh.
I think that one random text message we got from her today was like a death spasm.
That was the last text message we'll ever get.
Because, what was it? She texted us yesterday saying she wasn't feeling good, which is why she didn't respond. It was like 120 missed messages.
Oh, right.
And then God knows how many today. And then she's like, yeah, I'm not going to make it. I'm dying.
Yeah. She said she needed to go home. And then she went home and then took a nap and then texted us. And she was like, actually, you know what? I'm not going to be there today.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a shame because really could have used a female perspective on all the titties we're about to talk about.
Yeah, this is going to get a little weird.
It is going to get a little weird, but it's okay because, somebody's got to talk about sorority babes.
I'm here for it.
Might as well just be us, right?
I hope she's actually just watching it again by herself in bed.
I hope she is, too.
Slowly nursing her back to health, asking Uncle Impy to make her feel better.
I mean, it's the only way, right? Like, it's the surefire way to feel better.
I think so.
It could easily be one of her three wishes. 100%.
What would her other two wishes be?
Probably for, like, something to do with vodka and Red Bull, and then my death.
You know, I think you actually might have gotten all three of her wishes correct.
Sam.
Palmer.
How you doing this week, man?
I'm doing good. I'm doing pretty good.
Yeah?
Yeah.
It's
been a pretty straightforward, quiet week at work for me, unlike you.
It won't be quiet for me for a while.
I think I've been enjoying my week just because I haven't been going through what you've been dealing with.
Yeah, it's been one event after another, but if you want to know about them, honestly, you can just look at any national news source. We've been all over.
Yeah.
Just Google Virginia Senate and enjoy the headlines that come up because there's been a lot.
And you get to stick around until 2 in the morning because they can't get their shit together.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. That was my Tuesday night. And then immediately had to go into work the next morning at 8 o'clock, be there by 8 o'clock. And my son didn't sleep a whole lot. So
because
I was
your dog started barking when you got home. Yeah,
so I was running on like a grand total of like an hour.
Did she
hour
do that,
and a half of sleep.
Did she do that thing again where she like charged at you thinking you were breaking in?
No. Thank God. That would have like... I don't think I would have even gotten that hour and a half of sleep if that would have happened. No, she didn't do that. She just started barking and was not... Just very perplexed as to why I was arriving home so late.
Fair.
Yeah.
Seems fair.
It does seem fair, but there's been a lot of other things outside of our work lives that have happened this week. We had the Oscars.
Yeah, yeah. My sleeper movie of the year that would have been my number one if I could actually continue to consider it a genre film, which I can't, took pretty much swept, much to your chagrin, I think.
Not really my chagrin. It just wouldn't have been my first choice.
Okay. Well, I think you started going down the rabbit hole when it was, I think, this morning when you started texting about Snowpiercer.
Yeah. Well, no, that was sparked because I saw a Reddit post that apparently the director, what's his name?
Bong Joon-ho.
Yeah, he got into some beef with Harvey Weinstein over the scene where he like guts the fish.
Yeah.
And puts like the fish guts on the blade.
Mm.
So apparently like Harvey Weinstein was really pushing to lose that scene. And he was like, no, my dad was a fisherman. Just straight up lied to Harvey. He was just like, yo, my dad was a fisherman. This scene means so much to me. His dad wasn't a fisherman.
Harvey was like, replace it with some rape.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
There's not enough rape in this movie. We need to ruin some poor girl's life.
But I realized after that he was the same director.
Yeah.
And then I was like, wait a minute. Well, and then it led to our conversation about
gotcha.
How I dislike Snowpiercer and you liked Snowpiercer. So.
I mean, Snowpiercer is a weird one for me because I've seen it, I think, 3 or 4 times at this point, and I was late to catch that train when it first came out. I don't think I saw it for about a year after it came out. The first time I watched it, I didn't quite get it. Like, I didn't understand why everybody was so high on it. Second time I watched it, I thought it was great. And then consecutive, like, the viewings since, it's fallen into that category of just, it's all right. It's yeah, fine. It's fine. It's fine. Not a bad movie by any means. I don't think it's a fantastic movie by any means.
There's a lot of people out there that do think it's a fantastic film.
It's got a hell of a cast, though. I'll give it that.
Yeah, it does.
Chris Evans, Ed Harris, Tilda Swinton.
It is a crazy cast. I'll give you that. I don't know. I remember like hearing about the hype behind it and then watching it and just being like,
Yeah. It took a couple of viewings for me to really enjoy it. Now, I mean, I still enjoy it. I still think it's a good movie, but I'm not as high on it as I once was.
Hmm.
But
walked away from Parasite enjoying it.
Oh, I love the fuck out of that movie. I've watched it since, and I still think it's fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, I watched it. We got into a little bit of a chat as to like why I wasn't thrilled with the Parasite pick. I've seen it again, and I just feel like in subsequent views, it doesn't have the same punch.
I think I do agree with that. I think it kind of suffers the same way like The Sixth Sense did.
Or like
subsequent viewing is like the last 15 minutes of that movie, or maybe last 25 minutes. Once you find out about the basement, like,
let's not spoil that one for anybody.
Yeah, once you find out about the basement, subsequent viewings definitely take the punch away from it.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Everything that happens afterwards.
Right, and I mean like it's still a great movie. Don't get me wrong. I just like. Maybe it's only because I've only seen 1917 once. I don't know. Maybe that'll have the same effect on me. Like, if I rewatch that again, I'm like, this was just a gimmick.
No, I mean, I think it is, but at the same time, war movies have a staying power.
Yeah, I just, like, I walked away from that, like...
And I am surprised.
Very impressed. It left the same... it hit a lot of the same tones as the first time I saw Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah.
Just in the sense that, like, there was, I don't know, there was just a lot going on. It did, the perspective of the film did a lot. Like, you know how, like, Saving Private Ryan brought, like, a lot of, like, the wartime, like, carnage to the big screen?
Dude, that scene on the beach, man, that shit still holds
up. Yeah, that shit's fucking cool. Well, the whole movie still holds up, but, like, that movie, like, changed war films forever. And I think, like, putting it in this one-shot perspective behind this person that we're following the entire time, like, I thought that was a really... personal take on such a story that took place on a worldwide level, you know.
Yeah, I do find it interesting because, you know, big name war movies, and strangely, Saving Private Ryan was not one of these. I don't actually remember what won that year, but big war movies tend to really just clean up at the Oscars.
Yeah,
but the last one to actually win. The top prize was actually The Hurt Locker, and that was all the way back in 2009.
Didn't Hacksaw Ridge win some awards, that other Mel Gibson directed one?
I think it did, but it didn't. I don't think it was nominated for Best Picture.
Yeah. Hey, look. There's a Mel Gibson movie I wasn't a fan of. Hacksaw Ridge. I just did not care for that film. threw that one in the same scope as Passion of the Christ. Both just very, very agenda-based religious films.
Shakespeare in Love won Best Picture of the year of Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah, I remember being pretty disappointed by that, too. Like, as a kid, I had a lot invested in that for some stupid fucking reason.
Yeah.
It was the same thing when... I've talked about that on the cast, too, a couple of times, when Starship Troopers lost to Titanic for Best Special Effects that year.
Yeah.
I got so upset about that as a kid,
although,
too.
Saving Private Ryan did win Best Director for Spielberg.
Yeah. I mean, Saving Private Ryan pretty much cleaned up, like, every other category that year.
Sound editing, best sound... Best cinematography, best film editing, and was nominated for like 8 other awards.
Right.
So
right.
I mean, that's kind of my thing with it, though, is partly because of just the history of war movies doing so well at the Oscars. I kind of view them with a jaded eye, like most of them were just kind of Oscar bait. So it was nice, you know, beyond the whole foreign cinema winning best director for the first or best picture for the first time. It was nice to see, you know, an original story that wasn't, you know, some twist on some war setting kind of come in and upset everything.
Did you...
And also, fuck the Joker.
Did you happen to catch that YouTuber that lost his fucking mind, the clips that were circling around Twitter?
No.
Of that YouTuber that lost his fucking mind over Parasite?
No, I was too enthralled with Bong Joon-ho's reactions to wanting to drink all night.
Oh, right.
I'm going to drink a lot tonight. I probably won't stop until the morning.
Robert Storms, that's his name. He came out with a video called Oscars Go Full Woke.
Oh,
and
God.
And like 2 minutes, it was some, like a 2 minute clip went around. And he brought up.
Dude, just looking at this guy's face. All right. So I've never seen anything by this guy.
Neither have I. He's got a like 70,000 subscribers. He had a lot more, and he lost a bunch after this video.
He's got 24,000 subscribers currently, which is still a good amount. So this video's got about 200,000 views. So I've never seen this guy. I've never seen anything by this guy. He's wearing what looks like a Discount Affliction t-shirt.
Yeah.
A gold chain around his neck, a gingery ass beard, and his bright red face that looks like our Irish friend Danny when he drinks. one of those really silly.
Or when he works out.
Yeah. One of those really silly, like, flat kind of page boy hats.
Yeah.
And the still of this video is half of a screen of an Oscar statue. And the other half of him, like, screaming at the camera. And I can only imagine what he's got to say and how politically correct it is.
I don't even think he saw Parasite?
That wouldn't surprise me. Because I imagine that a lot of the people that are saying 1917 should have won probably saw that one and did not see Parasite. And I think part of that, though, Parasite had a much more limited release.
Yeah, it did. I think it's also, like, making up for it now. I think last I read it, was like it's been... The Oscars pushed it to be, like, one of the most popular VOD releases, apparently, like,
oh,
of
yeah,
all time
sure.
or something.
I did read, I think, Medium. Somebody from Medium wrote an article talking about how Bong Joon-ho has been on record saying that if you can get over that one-inch barrier of foreign films, there's a lot of great stuff out there. And this person on Medium was like... Subtitles are the fucking worst, and everybody knows it. And it's a real short little op-ed that's, like, maybe 500 words. And I'm just sitting there reading it the whole time. I'm like, I can't watch things without subtitles. It doesn't matter if it's English or not. I have to have subtitles on. I am curious how many of our listeners are on the anti-subtitle train.
I don't know. I honestly don't think it's a whole lot because we've talked about a lot of like foreign films and they're some of our most listened to episodes.
And I know you and I have gaslit Alex to the point where she can't watch movies without subtitles now.
Yeah, I mean, I just keep them on.
Yeah,
at this, you know, because
we've got subtitles on everything.
Well, now I have to like between the fact that I like am hard of hearing in my left ear
and you have a baby that you have to keep the noises down for.
I just. It's, 24-hour fucking subtitles all day, every day. If I could put subtitles on his fucking noise machines, I would. wave, ocean crash. But yeah, he I guess he didn't see Parasite or whatever, but he brings up this idea that if you won best foreign film, you shouldn't be able to win best picture.
Why not?
I don't know. That's what the whole like basis of his argument is, because like but it's I get because he was saying
it's not best. It's,
I think like,
why is there no best domestic category?
I don't. That's a good question.
Yeah, and if there is a best domestic category and you win that, can you win best picture? Shut up, Ginger Boy. Get a better hat.
But he sparked this whole like. Obviously, a bunch of people on Twitter got outraged. I just appreciate the fact
that I'm talking shit about this guy, and I've not watched his video.
Oh, I'm gonna.
I am here standing hard as fuck for Parasite.
But apparently, so a lot of people got outraged on Twitter, because that's what happens on Twitter. People get outraged.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of the internet.
And so the clip of this video. The funny thing is, so his video itself only has like 193,000 views. The clip that was circulating on Twitter had like 250,000 views.
Really?
Yeah. And so I'm looking at his Twitter.
Well, Twitter's my next visit.
His own Twitter account, and he doesn't have that much activity there, but this clip of him just went viral. And so people lost their minds over it. Obviously, it hasn't helped him one bit at all. I guess it probably got him more comments on his actual channel, because there are 11,000 comments on this channel.
Hashtag fuck Parasite. This dude is real, real butthurt about it.
He's not happy with it. But yeah, I don't know. It's an interesting idea though. Like with it winning the best foreign or being best foreign film and best picture, and that setting the precedent for that. Do you think that means that like from here on, foreign films will have a much better chance, or do you still think they're standing on like you think they've got dead weight still?
I think this is one good step for it. I don't think that we're going to see a big wave of foreign cinema even getting nominated. Because, I mean, at the end of the day, it's five nominations, right, for this category?
Yeah.
This was one foreign film. And I can think of a couple other ones that could have easily been considered, at the very least, to take the place of Joker. I still don't know why that was nominated for Best Picture. I don't know either.
The movie. Have you seen it yet?
I have.
You have? Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, it was good. It was fine, yeah.
It's good. I'm not saying it's a bad movie, but Best Picture?
Nah, no way.
Like, all right, Best Lead Actor? Got it. Yeah. Makes sense. I think that's why
he won that, right?
Like, yeah, give Joaquin all of the fucking statues in the world.
Did you see people chewing him out about his speech?
No.
Twitter got really mad about his speech.
Twitter's just getting mad about everything. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, even looking at genre films, I think last year was a much better year for foreign movies than domestic. And some of them are like the genre-bending kind that you don't even have to be a fan of horror movies to like. Like Tigers Are Not Afraid. And you could make a potential case for that movie getting nominated for something. I think it's still a very high bar to cross to get non-domestic films into certain categories.
Right.
Even with Parasite winning.
I think that this is going to set... Obviously, it already has set a precedent. I think it'll be a little easier, but yeah, I'm with you. I think it's still going to be a ways off before we see foreign films get the same type of.
At the end of the day, we're all still a bunch of Americans.
Well, yeah, but the other. So we're praising this film, right? This movie just won an Oscar. It just came out. HBO is making a fucking 6-part series of it.
Yeah, but that was already being planned.
Oh, was it? I didn't know that. I thought this was like after.
No, that was already being planned before. Like, I think the announcement of that happened right around the same time that the nominations were announced. But that was already in the works before it won.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I didn't know that. I thought that was like as a result of the Oscars.
No, I think a lot of it though was people trying to figure out why.
Like, it needs a I don't understand like, it.
I don't understand why.
Because we're Americans, we have to remake everything, so it doesn't
really
have subtitles.
We really do. And it's funny. It used to be that we would at least give like a moratorium period and wait, I don't know, 5-10 years before doing it. I think my first experience with like a really fast turner, there was this British movie called Starbuck that was remade with Vince Vaughn.
Why do I know that name?
Like a year and a half or 2 years after the original one released, and it was garbage. And ever since then, I feel like we've gotten really, really gung-ho about remaking foreign shows and movies just because. And I don't really know why.
Yeah, I don't understand it.
Now, granted, my wife's favorite one of my wife's favorite shows is a remake of a British show. So, you know, what do I know?
I mean, that's true. Every once in a while you get the remake and it turns out to be pretty good in some cases.
I just don't understand.
In the rare case, superior.
I just don't know how you're turning this movie into a 6-part show.
I could see it. I think there's some stuff you could tap into with HBO's writers. They always manage to draw things out for way longer than they need to be. Yeah, that's true too. we were going to talk about retitling movies also, but this conversation has gone on for like 20 minutes. So
that's all right.
I'm going to go ahead and say we should probably just move things over to the horror headlines.
All right.
All right, starting things off with some sad news. Nazi exploitation and femme fatale Diane Thorne has passed on. Diane Thorne, better known to fans as the one and only Ilsa She-Wolf of the SS, passed away last night at the age of 83 after a long battle.
Last week.
Oh, yeah, it was Friday.
No, it was a couple weeks
ago. What did I say, last night? Last week, that's what I meant to say.
A couple weeks ago. That January 28th.
Was it?
Yeah.
Oh, wow, okay.
So a couple weeks ago.
She passed away at the age of 83 after a long battle with pancreatic cancer. Thorne was a stunning actress that stole pretty much every scene she was in due to her on-screen presence. Her role as Ilsa is one of the most intense and respected out of the erotic exploitation films of the 70s. She went on to play Ilsa twice more in Ilsa, Harem Keeper of the Oil Sheiks.
What a name.
And Ilsa, Tigress of Siberia.
Keeper of the Oil Sheiks. What a great name. They're ridiculous films, man. What a great name.
Eventually, I do want to get around to watching this.
Hey, I'm all
when
for
we
it.
Do like I've a only seen the first month. One. It's gotta happen. These films were definitely products of their time and could probably never be produced now, but curious exploitation fans that want to experience the sleazier side of the era probably won't find a better example of women in prison movies or genre films than these. Our regards go out to her and her family. She'll be missed. Paramount is releasing a 40th anniversary special edition Blu-ray of one of the most iconic slasher films of all time, Friday the 13th, the film that sparked a massive money-making horror enterprise whose rights are still being fought for as we speak, has a huge anniversary coming up, and Paramount are no strangers to cashing in on the event. A special edition Steelbook Blu-ray digital release will feature a 4K transfer of the uncut version of the film. The Steelbook features the iconic original poster artwork for the film in the front, along with Killer Mommy Kill Her etched on the back. Paramount released this statement. With the addition of the unrated footage and insightful special features, plunge deeper into a film that spawned 11 sequels in the genre's unstoppable bad guy, Jason Voorhees. A new owner and several young counselors get together to reopen Camp Crystal Lake, where a young boy drowned and several vicious murders occurred years earlier. They have ignored local warnings. That place has a death curse.
I mean, duh.
Yeah, right. Wouldn't you?
I would.
You're all doomed. And one by one, they find out how unlucky Friday the 13th can be as they're stalked by a violent killer.
I know there's been like a huge surge in Blu-ray and 4K recuts.
Yep.
I feel like this one's already come out.
I don't know that it's come out on like a 4K release like this, but honestly, unless you're a collector that really wants another Steelbook, I don't see the point. Like, it did come out. Remember we talked about that really, really shitty French release of it?
Maybe that's what I'm confusing this with.
Like a while back?
Yeah.
With a terrible
artwork. With the blue
artwork.
Cover, right?
Yeah, yeah, with a terrible
artwork on
the front.
Maybe that's why I'm mixing this up.
I just don't understand why you wouldn't, like, package this in with, like, a machete. Or, like, put it in a Jason mask or something, you know? Like, really dig deep and try to find some serious... Like, do a new interview... Do a new set of interviews with cast members. Like, get Kevin Bacon to talk about this shit. You're fucking...
Dude, $10 and I think he'll talk about anything.
Yeah, right? Like, come on. Well, I'm pretty sure we could probably get Kevin Bacon on the cast if we really wanted to.
God, if that ever happens, I swear to God, I'm just gonna lose my fucking mind. And I'm gonna immediate my very first question. Is going to be, can you please send me the pilot to Tremors?
The TV show that Sci-Fi gives?
I know you've got a copy of that pilot floating around, man. Can you send it to us, please, Kevin?
I don't know. Put it inside of like a Kevin Bacon head. That would have been cool.
Yeah.
That would have been cool. Why don't you do something like that? I don't know. Hopefully Paramount has more announcements up its sleeve before the anniversary is up. Last but not least, The Hunt. Is finally on.
Hashtag free Betty's free.
Blumhouse and Universal Films The Hunt caught some flack from white-wing sensationalists that claimed the film was promoting a violent agenda against them. After our tufted haired wonder of a president, we retweeted that the trailer it was violent nonsense. He called for a boycott against the film, and Universal felt pressured to cancel its original release date of September 27th. Of last year, stating, "We stand by our filmmakers and will continue to distribute films in partnership with bold and visionary creators like those associated with the satirical social thriller, but we understand that now is not the right time to release this film." Apparently, they feel that enough time has passed because, once again, it's on the docket for release, this time scheduled for March 13th, starring Betty Gilpin, Hilary Swank, and written by Damon Lindelof of... the recently well-received Watchmen that's apparently not getting a second season, so what the fuck?
Oh, really? It's
not? Yeah. He doesn't... He's moving
viewership
away.
Viewership or something else?
No, it was, like, really successful, but Lindelof is... he's going on to direct something else, so he's not going to have time to write the show, and HBO is like, well, we don't want to continue this without you, so
peace. I was going to say, they couldn't find anybody else to pick it up?
I don't think it's that. I think it's that they genuinely don't want to continue it unless they can keep the team together.
Interesting.
So it's not continuing. The movie's about 12 strangers who wake up in a clearing. They don't know where they are or how they got there. They don't know how they've been chosen, or don't know that they have been chosen for a very specific purpose, which is the hunt. The surprise announcement comes with a new trailer as well, which it feels like it gave a little too much away, honestly.
No, I think it came. I think it towed that line.
Yeah.
I don't think it actually did.
You think it'll be like Ready or Not, where it felt like it did, but it didn't.
Yeah, I think it towed that line because there's a lot of little different bits and pieces, but they cut all of the scenes so quickly and sharply that I think there's going to be a lot more to this movie than they're letting on. I will give them credit, though. They definitely took this one in stride because they got a really great fucking tagline for it as the most talked about movie of the year. Is one that no one's actually seen.
Yeah.
Decide for yourself, and then September 27th is crossed out and replaced with March 13th, which happens to be Friday the 13th. And according to Jason Blum, not a single scene has changed.
Good. I'm glad to hear that.
I am curious, though, if given the reason it was shelved initially, if Donald Trump is going to... catch wind of this and start tweeting again.
I don't think they'll push it back because of him again, though. I think they'll just let it go.
Yeah. I'm also surprised this is still getting a theatrical release because I expected after this it was going to go straight to VOD.
I did expect that too, but I think they put too much money in this to not let it
go. Plus, Betty needs to be on the big screen.
Yeah.
I love her in Glow, but it's time to see her on the big screen.
I'm with you. As per usual, we'll link the trailer in the podcast description. Sam, you got Now Slang, right?
We sure do.
All right.
All right, so starting it off this week, Fantasy Island on the 14th, so Valentine's Day. You can
go to... Is this porn or is this a...
Fantasy Island, no, man. So you were not here when we first talked about this.
I guess this was
a me and Alex only episode. Coming by way of Blumhouse and hitting theaters all around the country. In Blumhouse's new spin on Fantasy Island, The enigmatic Mr. Rourke makes the secret dreams of his lucky guests come true at a luxurious but remote tropical resort. But when the fantasies turn into nightmares, the guests have to solve the island's mystery in order to escape with their lives.
Dun, dun, dun.
It is said, however, that the iconic tattoo character from the original show will not appear in this film. So at this point, I don't really know what the fuck the point of this movie is anymore.
Dun, dun, dun.
Next up, VFW, also on Valentine's Day from RLJE Films on VOD. A group of war veterans must defend their local VFW post and an innocent teen against a deranged drug dealer and his relentless army of punk mutants.
I've heard really good things about this.
Really?
Yeah.
It's an interesting cast. So it's got Martin Cove, who was Kreese, the head of the rival dojo in Karate Kid, and Fred Williamson, who was Frost in From Dusk Till Dawn. I think this is going to be really bad, but one of those, like, instant cult classics.
It's been pretty well received so far.
Next up, we got Camp Coldbrook, also on Valentine's Day, from Scream Factory, getting a limited theatrical release and instant VOD. Reality TV producer and host Jack Wilson finds himself in a tough spot when a show is about to be canceled in a last-ditch effort to spark ratings. He and his producer choose to film their next episode at the legendary Camp Coldbrook, which is host to a horrific accident where the young campers were drowned in a nearby creek 20 years ago. I can only assume it's like Friday the 13th.
Yeah, I was going to say, I feel like I've heard the story before.
Their arrival begins like any other episode, but the TV crew finds that they get more than they bargained for. And finally this week, strangely enough, so this was mentioned on Side Stories this week, and I was already getting ready to dunk on it, but after hearing the great Henry Zebrowski talk so much about one of our least favorite movies of last year, I'm going to dunk on it a little bit more. After Midnight comes
Does
out on
Valentine's Day.
Does
he star in this
Day.
Movie? He stars in this
he
movie,
is not
right?
in this the guy from our least favorite?
No, Henry Zebrowski. Isn't he in this movie?
He might be. I don't actually know.
I think he is.
That I don't know. I know he's very good friends with the guy that stars in this movie. So, After Midnight from Cranked Up Films on VOD, dealing with a girlfriend, suddenly leaving is tough enough, but for Hank, heartbreak couldn't have come at a worse time. There's also a monster trying to break through his front door every night. So,
oh no, yeah, he's just friends.
This movie stars Jeremy Gardner.
Oh no, he's in this as Wade.
Okay, so this movie stars Jeremy Gardner, who was also in Bliss.
Bliss, yeah.
We've both seen that movie get a lot
not,
of like positive press,
like that movie.
And apparently Henry fucking loves that movie. And I don't know if it's because he's really good friends with Jeremy Gardner.
Probably,
but that movie was really not good.
Listeners, you're going to have to write in and let us know if you guys enjoyed that movie and what you enjoyed about it. Maybe I'm just missing the point.
I might just not be able to get over just the Samuel L. Jackson doesn't say fuck that much. I don't know. Maybe I just couldn't get past that. The movie looked cool. Definitely didn't hold up. And if Jeremy Gardner, if that movie is any indication of what to expect with this movie, I'm not holding out too much hope.
Okay.
But that's what we got for this week. So a longer list than we've been doing, but all of these have been getting quite a good amount of press. So figured I'd let everyone know.
Did you see, what's it called? That new Elijah Wood movie yet?
Mm-mm.
Come to Daddy?
Not yet.
It's pretty good.
Is it?
Yeah. I enjoyed it. I got a kick out of it. Some good kills.
I'm liking Elijah Wood, man.
Definitely went in a direction I was not expecting.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, I enjoyed it. It's got my recommendation. I think it's like $7 to rent, but it's like $9 to just buy. So I just bought it.
I think that's how I wound up buying Bliss.
Oh, because it was like
the same price to buy it as to rent it. So I was just, all right, here's $6.
Yeah.
I wish I had it back.
Yeah, it's on Shudder.
And yeah, it wasn't when I bought it.
It is what it is. That's the way of the world, right?
Yep.
All right, let's kick off our main event. Sorority Babes.
Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to tonight's main event.
Sam?
Yeah.
You want to introduce this, buddy?
Yeah. So we are, as we briefly mentioned at the top of this episode when we were talking about retitled films, this movie, Sorority Babes in the Slimeball Bowlerama, was originally known as The Imp. given its colorful creature of the same name. What is this movie about? After watching the Animal House style paddling, Revenge of the Nerds gets real weird when their panty raid unleashes a sentient version of our unofficial sponsor's Bad Dragon main line of products. And this is also why we don't fucking roll on Shabbos.
I like that one. Well done. Well done. Well done. Fucking behind the line, goddammit.
Over the line!
Sorority Babes was released in 1988. Full name Sorority Babes and the Slime Ballerama. That's probably going to be the one time you ever hear me say the full name, because...
That's a lot of words.
It is a lot of words. Directed by David DeCoteau. Writer Sergei Hasnich,
I think.
Oh, okay, sure. That sounds better. Andres Jones is Calvin. Linnea Quigley is Spider. Robin Style is Babs Peterson. Unfortunately, I read that she committed suicide in 1996.
Robin Style? Robin Rochelle, I guess, is her, also known as. I didn't know that. I didn't know she killed herself or died.
She allegedly had a bit of an alcohol abuse problem.
It happens.
Yeah, it's a shame. Hal Havens as Jimmy. He's also a Knight of the Demons. John Stewart Wildman as Keith. Brink Stevens as Taffy. Michelle Bauer as Lisa. Kathy Obrecht as Rhonda. Carla B. as Frankie. George Buckflower as the janitor.
The best part. Best guy in the whole fucking movie.
And then Michael Saunier is Uncle Impy, but he's in there as Dookie Fly Swatter.
I mean, if you're going to go with a screen name, why not? Get fucking weird.
For sure.
If a lot of these names sound familiar, it is because Full Moon Pictures put this movie out. And that's one of those groups, kind of like... I can't remember the name. Toxic Avenger. The group behind that.
Oh, the Trauma Team?
Yeah, the Trauma Team, where a lot of the cast... a lot of the same cast, just kind of working with the same directors over and over again.
Yeah, they find who they like, and they just roll with them again. I mean, I feel like that's like the trademark of some of these 80s low-budget films.
Yeah. It obviously works, because I think there's a level of comfort that kind of comes between sets and series.
I would agree with that. It makes me wonder how that Full Moon Pictures streaming service is doing, or if they're still doing it.
I'm curious, because this movie is supposedly getting a sequel.
Is it really?
So Full Moon, apparently last April, had announced, as part of this streaming thing, the Deadly 10 promotion, which planned film prom... planned film releases returning stars of the original film, Linnea Quigley, Brinkie Stevens, and Michelle Bauer, along with the original director. And they were planning on doing 10 movies. So Blade of the Iron Cross, Bride of the Head of the Family, Necropolis Legion, Sorority Babes and the Slimeball Bolarama 2, Blood Rise Subspecies 5, Halloween Night, The Hourglass, Familion, Cosmic Crush, The Shadow Heart Curse, and The Grim Rapper.
I think I remember The Grim Rapper. I feel like we talked about that one at some point when we talked about the streaming service that they were doing.
Apparently, as part of that, if this ever actually does happen, it's supposed to be a bunch of companion, behind-the-scenes, like interviews and on-set stuff.
Oh, okay.
Which would be really interesting to see.
Yeah, for sure. Sorority Babes is more than just one hell of a title. The only thing that I can think of that rivals it in the outside world, outside of the world of anime, is the recent Birds of Prey, which also just got retitled Harley Quinn Birds of Prey, rather than the Fantabulous Emancipation of One Harley Quinn, because that's a fucking ridiculous title also.
Well, it's because it was Birds of Prey, colon, the super long name,
yeah. And
most people aren't going to read that.
Yeah.
So they didn't...
know what it was.
A casual viewer is not like, oh, it's a comic book movie. It's Harley Quinn. Okay.
Yeah. It's a heartwarming tale about the power of friendship, finding strength in adversity, and acceptance.
And learning how to drink more than one beer.
Exactly right. Fucking Calvin. Teaches us that and no matter what, we are the greater than the sum of our desires. And when faced with overwhelming odds, we can stand our ground and fight back against whatever perils lay in our way. No. That was all just a lie. Now you know what it feels like when somebody presents you with something that's just too good to be true, just like Uncle Limpy did with the poor victims in this film. The truth is, this film is exactly what it sounds like. It's sleazy, over-the-top, low-budget teenage daydream realized in just under an hour and 20 minutes.
I do appreciate that. I love a good short runtime.
Yeah, yeah. It's got just enough of a plot to keep the excuses for nudity going, had some incredibly bad practical effects, and sprinkles some blood and humor in for good measure. Made with a budget of just $90,000, which is incredible. Yeah. I can't believe they got a movie that looks this good for $90,000. We've seen films that have been shot for like four times this much that look like shit.
Yeah.
Yeah. This looks like a
we'll talk about the budget. Well, no, let's go. Let's talk about the budget right now.
Okay.
So not long, it was around the same time. I think it was 2 years beforehand, Chopping Mall was made.
Right. I fucking love that movie.
It's a great movie.
Yeah.
If this movie had a better budget, it could have just been Chopping Mall 2, Back Alley Beatdown. All you have to do is take out the robots and swap locations, and it's pretty much the same idea.
Yeah, it is.
You know what the difference in the budget is between these two movies?
I want to say like $800,000. Like, yeah. I feel like Chopping Mall was like, it had to have been around a million.
Yeah, Chopping Mall was $800,000 to make.
Was it?
Yeah.
All right. Well,
could you like just imagine like as much as they did with this movie with a $90,000 budget?
Yeah, it's crazy.
Just imagine what they could have done if you gave it the kind of budget the Chopping Mall got.
Well,
or even half of it.
Maybe we'll find out with Sorority Babes too.
Yeah, you'd only be so lucky. Quick, everybody sign up for the Full Moon streaming service.
Yeah, right. The movie stars the wonder trio of Scream Queen and B-movie vixens for the first time ever together on film. Linnea Quigley, Brink Stevens, and Michelle Bauer. We've talked about Linnea Quigley twice on this cast already with Return of the Living Dead and Night of the Demons, and this film marks the third. She's quickly become a favorite topic of conversation among the three of us because of her willingness to bear it all.
Love her.
But this marks her first more, shall we say, reserved role.
I think when I sat down to watch this and I said I was just waiting to see Linnea get naked and you said keep waiting.
Yeah.
Or you're going to be waiting a long time. I think I replied hashtag infinite sadness.
In spite of her high cut halter top that definitely gives viewers glimpses of what's underneath, she leaves a lot to the imagination in this one. Don't get too disappointed, though, because there's plenty of gratuitous nudity coming from the likes of Brink Stevens and Michelle Bauer, both who spend a good portion of the film's first 20 minutes in sexually provocative positions.
Thank you, sir. May I have another?
Bathing together in the shower and wearing nothing but skimpy underwear. Fans of David Decoteau's work will feel right at home with this kind of material, though. Out of the 90-plus films he's helmed, his work is no stranger to sleazeball content, with titles like Nightmare Sisters, Naked Instinct, Beach Babes from Beyond, and Bikini Goddesses. You can probably see what direction...
I wonder what those movies are about.
Yeah, right? You can probably see what direction this guy's heading in. Though his modern work is apparently primarily gay horror erotica now.
Good for him, man. Everybody's got to find a niche.
Yep. 1313. Look that series up on IMDb. There's like 40 of them.
That sounds really familiar, actually.
Decoteau was born in Oregon, but he settled in British Columbia, getting his start in film when he was 18. He primarily discovered and was mentored by none other than Roger Corman, who brought him on as a production assistant in 1980. His career evolved based on necessity, and as a result, he never really became a stickler for any type of film as long as they resided in the realm of exploitation. In a 2014 interview with Flavor Wire, he stated, "I always wanted to make what I could sell, so I just promised myself that I would not be set in my ways. If somebody said, look, we need a horror film, we need a creature feature, we need a Western, we need a period costume drama, I was able to put it together pretty quickly." As a result, his popularity grew as a man that could get things done on a budget, on time, and with enough pizzazz to intrigue viewers and make money.
And then he made the 1313 series. So the reason I thought that sounded familiar was a Star Wars 1313.
Oh.
Completely unrelated.
Yeah, not
really. If you go to IMDb and type in 1313, however, you get a nice long list of this series where the dude has found a way to sell some shit and make some money. And the covers of all of these are pretty much the same. A, you know,
group of half-naked men.
A group of half-naked men, occasionally a woman, some sharp objects, and some muscle poses. Yeah,
they remind me of the Tinglers.
Yeah,
the Chuck Tinglers.
If Tinglers could be movies,
that would probably be what those are.
Yeah.
So, how did this movie get its name? The film initially started with the name The Imp, like Sam said, and was still released with that overseas. But producer Charles Band felt that the title was no longer relevant, so he held a contest amongst his employees at Empire Records to come up with a new title for the film.
Empire Pictures.
Oh, sorry. What did I say?
Empire Records.
Whoops. I'm a little tired this week,
you guys.
That's
all right, man.
Bear with me.
That's what I'm here for.
The winner of the contest was the title Bitchin' Sorority Babes in a Slimeball Bolarama, which the entire cast hated except for Andres Jones, who loved it.
Shocking that he, of all people.
Right?
He of the one beer was like...
That's I love perfect. That title. That's amazing.
That's perfect.
Fortunately, the MPAA said that they couldn't use the word bitchin' in a movie title and forced them to drop it, leaving us with the one we know and love.
Which is a shame.
MPAA, it is.
Come on,
I
man.
I feel like it would have actually made the title better.
I think so. I am strangely with Andreas on this one.
We open up with some nerdy frat boys named Calvin, Jimmy, and Keith as they sit around doing frat boy things like drink beer and watch movies.
And read porn.
Yeah, right? Just porn all over the walls.
Yep.
I love that in like 80s movies, whenever it's like a guy's room, there's just porn plastered all over the mm-hmm. walls.
It's just every centerfold you can imagine is pinned up to the wall.
I never knew anybody that had that. Like
I knew
up.
One person, but it wasn't
was
all
it
over
Aton?
The walls. No, it wasn't. It was never all over the walls. He had two very specific centerfolds pinned up on his walls.
Huh. Well, good for him. They sit around doing frat boy things like drinking beer and watching movies. Jimmy, the chunkiest of the bunch, mentions that there's no sorority or that there is a sorority initiation going on that night. After some convincing, Calvin, the nerdiest and most antisocial of the trio, finds some liquid courage in the form of one single beer and agrees to follow and spy on the Tri-Delta sorority group. The opening scene kind of says, two things about the film? One, this movie isn't going to be winning any awards in the dialogue or character development categories. And even if they do manage to bring some sort of slightly compelling dynamic between Linnea Quigley's character... Spider and Calvin later down in the film. I don't know. There's not like a whole lot else that it brings to the table in that regards. Then again, with the film title being what it is, I'm not sure that you'd really be expecting anything like that.
Yeah.
The budget, the film's already screaming low budget. We're only shooting inside a living room, but the camera work is, it's adequate, but it's not stellar by any means.
They make a small room work.
Yeah, they do. The production is shoddy and the sound work, which is my biggest issue with this film, is meager at best. The sound work might actually take away from the film more than I would have liked it to.
So I'm quickly learning that, you know, especially when we did like the indie month.
Yeah.
Low budget, sound is the first thing to go.
Yeah. I feel like that we experienced that a lot with, God, what the hell is the name of that cult film that we watched about the girl who was taking on Medusa? Remember, she was like, her dad was like a super racist, like Greek gods guy. They were in like a cabin in the mountains.
I'm completely lost on this one.
She kept seeing a Gorgon.
Oh, fuck.
You remember that movie?
Yeah.
God, I can't remember the name of it, but like every time the Gorgon would appear, it was like 80 times louder than the rest of the film. You remember that? Yeah, I'm with you. Sound work seems to be the biggest issue with a lot of these low-budget films. It's almost impossible to hear certain lines, even with the sound cranked up, and I had to watch most of it with subtitles on.
Yay, subtitles!
Here's a clip of the dialogue between Jimmy and Keith doing their best to channel Revenge of the Nerds to set the tone. The two are discussing Felta Delta.
Felta Delta!
The nickname for the Tri-Delta sorority, while Calvin watches horror films in the background.
Well, I know where the Tri-Delta sorority is having their initiation tonight.
Yeah? Felta Delta?
Just might be able to watch. I think that's worth a brewski or two. I heard it starts at midnight, and I've got the perfect window to watch.
What are they gonna do?
I don't know, but Babs Peterson's in charge. And you know she's gonna have him bending over.
I'd like to bend her over.
Yeah, you and me both.
This is gonna be great, man. Let's go.
Calvin. Hey, Calvin. What the heck are you guys doing?
You wanna go?
Go where? To the Felta Delta initiation.
No thanks, I'm watching a movie.
Jeez, what a dork.
I can't believe this, man. A guy's finally turned himself into a vegetable.
What are you doing? I'm checking for a pulse.
Come on, you can watch this crap anytime. You got something better.
Not likely.
What's the matter? Don't you want to see some cute babe's butt up in the air with bab wax
ooh,
on it?
Ooh, sounds really enticing, Jimmy. Really does. Really does. Ooh, boy. Last year, there was a school with great boobs. And Babs makes her wear a bra full of worms. And then do push-ups. Deep push-ups. That's disgusting.
You're sitting there watching zombies eating people. That's disgusting, man.
It's not a zombie, it's a succubus. And anyways, it's just a movie.
So this is real life. It'll be great.
Look, guys, sadomasochism just doesn't appeal to me.
It's naked girls.
Well, that appeals to me, yeah.
Glad to hear it. Give me beer. It can only help.
So that's an example of the brilliant writing in this film.
You know, I'll give them credit, though. The sorority girls are apparently way more creative in their hazing rituals than what I've heard of the fraternity boys.
Yeah, yeah.
No elephant walk here.
Not at all. We're already playing in some serious male fantasies. We've got hot co-eds being reluctantly forced into sexually charged hazing rituals. And then these young men being able to voyeuristically spy as all of this takes place.
Naked girls.
I feel like this kind of shit wouldn't fly these days. I'm just throwing that out there.
Probably not.
The 80s were a much different time. This movie is definitely living up to its title, though.
Yeah.
We haven't so much seen a boob yet, but they're coming.
Oh, are they ever.
They are coming. While the pervs get ready to head over to the sorority house, Tri-Delta members Babs, Rhonda, and Frankie prepare for the upcoming hazing, while newcomers Taffy and Lisa wait, discussing rumors about past hazings. Babs arrives, joined by Rhonda and Frankie, dressed in ominous black cloaks. Babs has a thing for punishment. In fact, she said it so much that I couldn't help but think of Ricky and his absurd punish lines from Silent Night, Deadly Night films. And she interrupts the initiates by claiming they weren't given permission to speak.
I mean, they weren't.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. The frat boys arrive and park themselves by a window outside their house just in time to watch as the two initiates dressed in nothing more than a high-cut halter top and panties get spanked with a paddle and are hosed down with whipped cream, giggling endlessly as they do so.
Are those even allowed to be considered halter tops?
Right? It's like it's really just like a quarter of a t-shirt,
man. They stop at the nipple.
They stare, mouths agape, as they witness the glory in front of them, making wisecracks and dealing with Calvin, who is clearly too drunk for his own good. Once the whipped cream stops flowing, the members convene to discuss the rest of the hazing, alluding to some more monster sinister plans. God.
So what's with the scare tactics, Babs? You sounded pretty evil back there. I'll say, didn't you get enough of your jollies with your paddle? I mean... You took more than we ever got.
Honey, I haven't begun.
Look out!
You know, you really should consider prison work, babe. Brutal Babs, the Wicked Warden!
The initiates head up to the showers, strip, and begin to clean the whipped cream off as they engage in what might be one of the more gratuitous shower scenes we've ever covered here on the cast.
Alex probably watched it like 7 times.
Yeah, she's probably like, God,
look at that 80s bush.
Yeah,
100%. Two for the price of one.
100%. The boys enter the house and head up the stairs, staring blatantly through the half-open door in a classic comedy style, with the three of their heads hovering in a column along the doorframe like some sort of horny totem pole. Of course, they're caught by Babs and the other members, who menacingly wield their paddles at them dominatrix style as they pause and think about what they're going to do with these three horny deviants.
That's a paddling.
Yeah, right? Babs herds the group downstairs and rattles off a list of possible punishments, including calling the cops or killing the boys. boys and claiming self-defense. One of those things is not like the other.
Dude, that movie's woke as fuck. And look, all you had to do was wait 30 years for the remake of Black Christmas.
Yeah, right. Babs takes a different route, though, and decides to force the guys to join the Tri-Delta Pledges for the rest of their hazing ritual. The group is then sent on a mission to break into the bowling alley located inside the nearby mall and steal a trophy to prove that they did it. Unbeknownst to them, Bob's father runs the mall, where the bowling alley is located, and can watch the group's every move through security cameras.
I felt really dumb, because when they said steal a trophy, I just thought it was like steal something from inside to prove that you
like
did it.
Oh, like as a trophy?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. And then they go into like the actual trophy room, and I'm like, I should have known better.
We get a brief scene of idiotic and poorly written banter between the newly paired groups as they drive towards the mall.
But are you 007?
Yeah, right. My 007 ink panel. What do you say? Oh, open any lock. Fucking Jesus. As they enter the bowling alley, it's not long before we're introduced to one of the film's ancillary characters, the janitor, played by the always awesome Buck Flower. He comes in for some of the film's more brilliant comic relief with a combination of slapstick and well-written banter. He runs into the trio of sorority sisters led by Babs as they post up in the mall security cameras, but we'll talk more about all of them later. Because of the movie's meager budget, the filming took place pretty much in two locations, the first half being at the residence of 1261 South Victoria Avenue in Los Angeles. This was used as both a sorority house and the frat house, and was also reused in two of other Linnea Quigley's films, Murder Weapon, which was out in 1989, and Linnea Quigley's Horror Workout in 1990. I'm going to have to dig up this Horror Workout thing, because if it's just her like doing a workout to horror music, I'm pretty in. The second filming location being the Plaza Camino Royale and Vista Entertainment Center in Carlsbad, California. The more important run-in is...
Well, specifically in the bowling alley, it had to be filmed at night. While everything was closed.
Yeah, because it was free and a lot less expensive at that point in time. So they had, what, from 9 p.m.
to... I think it was from 11 p.m. to 9 a.m.
9 a.m., okay. The more important run-in here is Spider, played by Linnea Quigley. She's sarcastic and rambunctious. She's a biker girl burgling the alley in whatever way she can by breaking open everything from cash registers to... arcade machines.
Hey, man, she was burgling my heart, too.
She's attempting to, at least. It doesn't really seem like she's having too much success cracking open anything with the crowbar. She got that cash register open, but she's standing over there by the arcade machines. She's not doing very well.
Hey, man, she's cracked open my love. But she's stolen it.
We've got her intro here.
Hi, you come here often? Jesus Christ. Sorry, I didn't mean to startle you.
You stay there, Pally, or I'll lay you right the fuck out.
Oh, hey, I'm not gonna hurt you or anything.
Damn straight you're not. You're no security guard.
Oh, no, I'm just...
That's close enough.
What's going on?
What is it?
Calvin, is this a friend of yours?
Sort of.
Yeah, dream on, Toad. What is this, Midnight Wimp Bowling League?
What are you, the Bride of Dracula?
Oh. Jump back. Prom queen's on the loose. Or is it high school hookers?
Well, this is Lisa, and this is Taffy.
Taffy?
Jesus.
What's the matter with Taffy?
Oh. Well, if you don't know Taffy, you deserve the name.
Anyway, Lisa and Taffy are being initiated into a sorority.
Oh, co-eds. Figures.
And in order to get into the sorority, they have to steal a bowling trophy.
Ooh, naughty. That's illegal.
Yeah, so what are you doing here, mopping up?
Yeah, and I'm almost done. So let's cut the shit and get out of here.
Linnea Quigley is definitely one of the saving graces in this film. All her scenes elevate the standard whenever she's in them, which isn't really saying too much because the standard is already pretty low. But that's not really a slight to any of the talent involved here. The movie was extremely low budget and shot in time constraints that were very tight. What, 12 days?
Yeah, 12 days.
So she's I don't know, she's always fun to watch in any movie that she's in, even if all of the acting across the board, and this is kind of subpar.
I mean, I think she carries it.
Yeah, she definitely does a good job. Her and Buck Flowers are really the two best parts of this film.
Yeah.
But apparently, Decoteau wanted to work with Quigley so much, he handed her the script and told her she could pick any role. When she settled in on Spider, it surprised him. She really embraced the role. And for good reason, too. Spider was a bit of a departure for Quigley, who's well known for nudity in most of her roles. But in an interview she did in 2004, Quigley revealed, "I didn't find nudity liberating at all. I had a hard time doing it every time I was required to be nude. Since the cast and crew all have to try to get on set like they have never seen a naked woman before, so I always tried to have closed sets. But now I'm doing different things. It took me long enough time to get to where I am, but I will always say that horror got me there."
And it's interesting, though. It's not that much of a departure, because this is really just her character from Night of the Demons with clothing on.
Yeah, but we still get, like, an extended, like, five-minute sequence of her boobs out in that movie, too.
Oh, the dancing scene?
Yeah, when she puts, like, the lipstick in there and everything. Yeah,
that's what I'm saying. Like, this is just that character that, and not naked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kind of changes the perspective on a lot of her roles after reading that. I kind of feel bad for her. I bet she wasn't totally out of her element, or else she wouldn't have done so many of them. But it's kind of sad that she got typecast in the same thing over and over again, especially since she seemed to feel a little uncomfortable with it.
Yeah.
I'm glad this role was one where she still got to be sexy, but more dominant force rather than anything else. She had a lot to say about this role on USA Up All Night, too. So fans of Joe Bob-esque shows should go and dig up those clips. They're all on YouTube.
Yep. I watched a couple of them.
Yeah, they're a lot of fun, actually. I'm going to have to kind of sync up some of the other films and see what they're all about. Calvin takes an immediate liking to Spider, offering to give her money and help her out. Spider declines, and after...
I've got a dollar.
Spider declines, and after meeting with the rest of the group, helps them break into the trophy room in exchange for being left alone. The group strolls in, picks out the biggest trophy they can find, and walks out. Bumping into Spider once more, she's talking to Calvin, who is still trying his best to put the moves on her. The group makes fun of him, calling Spider his girlfriend.
At this point, isn't she trying to break into the quarter slots of the arcade games?
Yeah, that's exactly what she's doing. All while totally ignoring, or attempting her best to ignore Calvin.
Yeah, he's just following around like a drunk puppy.
Yeah, but she leaps to Calvin's defense, scaring Jimmy and causing him to drop the bowling trophy on the ground.
Way to go, Butterfingers.
Yep. Smoke suddenly emerges from the base of the trophy, and subtle laughter can be heard in the background. Turns out the wisecracking and seemingly harmless creature named Uncle Impy was trapped inside the trophy, and for freeing him, he offers each one of the group members one wish. He's voiced by the one and only Michael David Saunier, better known by his stage name Dookie Flyswatter, and is bursting with cheesy humor and even cheesier puppeteering skills that are just barely passable when you stop to consider the film's $90,000 budget.
Ow! It's about time, too.
Holy shit.
Unholy shit.
Ow, baby! It was really cramped in there. Going to put it definitely crimping my style, too. That's better. Well. How do you do, boys and girls? Oh, your little faces are just so full of surprise. Well, I'm just as happy to be here as you are. Old Uncle Limpy's just a little bit cranky. No fun being locked up like that. Especially in a bowling trophy.
I don't believe this.
Are you for real?
Well, of course I'm for real. As real as you are. My. Whose little girl are you? And another one. Just as pretty. Such a sour face.
Stop it, you little prick.
Now, is that any way to talk to you, good old Uncle Impy? And just when I was going to grant a wish to each and every one of you boys and girls.
A wish? Who are you kidding?
What kind of wish?
Why, any wish you want.
Calvin seems to know right off the bat that this is an unholy imp by flexing his horror movie knowledge. He warns everybody not to use the wishes, but their greed, lust, and pride gets the best of them. Jimmy is granted his wish of gold stacks, Taffy, her wish of being the prom queen, and Keith, his wish of having sex with Lisa.
The prom queen thing is weird, because she's in college at this point.
Yeah. Maybe she's thriving on the past.
I guess so.
The trio of sorority sisters watch in awe from the security cameras as this takes place, wondering aloud if they can go down and get a wish too. Just as this happens, Uncle Impy attacks them with a strange energy. Frankie, which is really just like color changing.
Yeah. Have some blue!
Yeah. Frankie is turned into the Bride of Frankenstein, and Rhonda is turned into a demon minion. Babs, on the other hand, manages to flee before she's transformed. As Babs attempts to escape, she touches one of the exit doors, which lets out a strange electrical discharge upon contact, leaving her unconscious. It's at this point that the group finds out that the wishes requested were not really granted, with Jimmy's gold being made out of wood and Taffy's dress disappearing. So the strange thing here is kind of like that nothing really happens to Lisa's character. She kind of continues to be this sex-crazed maniac that tries to get Keith nude and in the mood. So really, Keith's wish was still granted?
Yeah, I think it was kind of... I think you're supposed to assume that she's just going to fuck him to death.
Oh, maybe. I don't know. It's a rather large inconsistency considering how quickly everything else goes wrong for Jimmy and Taffy, though. One would think...
It also wasn't her wish, though.
Yeah, so maybe that's just torturing her.
Yeah, maybe that's the torture for her.
Maybe. I was expecting her to turn into, like, more of a traditional maniac and try to kill Keith when I first watched this movie.
I just assumed she was just going to, like, fuck him to death. Mm. Bite off his penis or something.
Mm. Then again, that would just be one less excuse to show boobs as often as possible, so I guess the director just went with it.
And holy shit. So, there is a lot of nudity in this movie.
Right.
I wouldn't call it necessarily gratuitous, because it's a product of its time, and it is a sleazy exploitation movie.
Yeah.
However, this sequence between her and Keith, that is the only part I would consider gratuitous, because they cut back to it, like, Four times,
it's just the same thing.
And literally nothing's happened. She's just, like, sitting on top of him, naked.
She takes her bra off. She goes from being just in, like...
Well, so the first part is her, like, taking off his clothes and taking off her clothes.
Right.
And the next three times is her sitting there, boobs out, and just still trying to pull off his clothing.
Well, apparently he was supposed to get progressively more naked also.
Yeah.
And he refused to do the nudity.
Okay.
And so they were like, you have to wear at least whitey tighties. And he wouldn't even do that. He showed up in boxers.
Yeah.
So I don't know. This guy's a pansy.
Apparently. It's weird because they cut back to it like four times. And again, it's just she's naked, trying to get him naked. He's trying to get out of there. And that's the only part I would consider gratuitous, because for a movie that's already under 80 minutes, it really feels like by the third time they cut back to this, they're just padding on time.
Yeah, I agree.
But I guess if you're going to pad the runtime, show me some boobs.
Yeah, right.
My wife was out of town. I watched it on the big screen upstairs, lights off, hanging out, full volume.
I had a good time. Yeah, you enjoyed yourself. Throughout the rest of the film, the carnage ensues, almost all of which is bloodless, with the kills going on mostly off camera, but still remaining a tad imaginative and even being kind of brutal when you think about what's going on off camera. The newly created minions kill Jimmy by shoving his head into a ball polisher and then use his head as a bowling ball. After Jimmy is dispatched, Spider and Calvin hide from Rhonda, the sorority girl turned demon minion in a closet. They find a pistol in there, which is pretty lucky, I guess.
Convenient.
Yeah, right. Which they then use to shoot Rhonda, buying them enough time to flee. Meanwhile, Keith is still attempting to get away from the sex-crazed Lisa, who is now totally topless and making Keith touch her boobs. Keith realizes this is all moving way too fast for him.
This is all he wanted, man. And now you're backing out?
Now he's talking about, like, introducing her to his mom first and, like, all this other stuff. And it's just... It's a lot of pressure, I guess. He can't perform under pressure is what's going on here. And manages to get away momentarily, only to find himself face-to-face with a demon-possessed Rhonda. After a brief scuffle, Rhonda is joined by the Bride of Frankenstein, Frankie, and the two get the upper hand, killing Keith by shoving his face into a deep fryer.
Which is fucking dope.
Yeah, before moving on to Taffy, who they proceed to rip in half.
I love what they did with Taffy. As a budget constraint, being like, we don't have a, you know, prop body to rip in half and display. When Calvin and Spider find Taffy later, you see the top half of her.
Yeah.
And they've just hidden her legs behind a wall to make it look like she's been ripped in half. I think that's brilliant.
Yeah.
I think that's such a creative way to, and a classic method of, you know, showing something like that on a very limited budget.
For sure. For sure. Meanwhile, honestly, like, if you look at the one thing that kind of connects all these films and makes them a lot of fun to watch is kind of taking note of the creativity behind them.
Yeah.
Having to work within the realms of such a limited budget really kind of brings out the best in people sometimes.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Babs awakens from her electric shock, collapses in fear. She's tormented by Uncle Impy. During this bit of dialogue, we learn a bit about Impy and the creatures he's been creating.
You going, my pretty?
Oh, God.
Not leaving so soon, are you?
Oh, damn you.
Already done, I'm afraid.
Who are you? Why are you doing this? What did you do with Ron and Frankie?
Please, so many questions. Let's take them one at a time. I'm an imp, one of the minor imps to be sure, but not without certain powers and magical capabilities, as you have seen. Wanda and Frankie have been made over into demons of a sort. Demonic stamina, but without spellcasting powers. You know, the both of them. My own fault for choosing such unpromising material. Coeds, really. What I am doing is tormenting you. That is what imps do. Goofy. And I do take pride in my work. But then I pull the wings off of flies.
Please, stop this.
You don't understand. I have to do this. I must.
No. No.
A nasty lesson for a nasty girl.
After Impy finishes his explanation, Babs is forced to fight Rhonda. She escapes the scuffle by shoving Rhonda into an alley where she's seemingly killed by Spider with a bowling ball. With Rhonda dead, Babs is possessed and turns into a BDSM demon minion fitting of her dominatrix persona.
What a great outfit.
Yeah, so I kind of wanted to talk about the logistics behind kind of how demons die in this film.
They just kind of do.
But it's so, like, inconsistent, right? So we see that, like, bullets don't really do a lot of damage, but we also see later in the film that bullets to the head don't really do a lot of damage. So what does it take? Like, serious blunt trauma to the brain to be able to bring him down?
Maybe. I don't really know, but I also... This isn't exactly one of those movies where I try to think about it too much.
Maybe I'm just overanalyzing.
I don't think this movie really ascribes to the standard demon fighting techniques that we've seen in other ones.
That's probably true. That's probably true. Calvin and Spider find the janitor, which leads them to one of the film's most memorable scenes. The janitor...
He also has the best lines in the movie.
Yeah, yeah, he's got quite a few of them. The janitor reveals that Uncle Impy was a result of black magic. A bowler with a terrible reputation on the lanes used black magic to summon the imp in order to get a better bowling score. It worked, and suddenly he could never miss a strike. But as a result, people went missing. With their bodies starting to be found, the bowler was blamed for the deaths and subsequently executed, setting the imp on a dangerous rampage. He was finally trapped inside the bowling trophy and has remained there for the past 30 years. Buckflower really steals the scene here as the old janitor. A bit between him and Quigley ensues as she attempts to get him to understand what she's saying, but ends up being misunderstood each time, leading him on a different and hilarious tangent.
Deaf.
Yeah. We've got a clip spliced together as some of the highlights of that scene.
All the terrible things started to happen. Everybody who'd ever made fun of or laughed at old Dave, I mean even just a little bit, they started turning up dead, and I mean awful dead, all ripped apart. It was a terrible thing to see.
Enough, Pops.
Yeah, you're right. They did call the cops. And the cops figured old Dave done it, and they took him away. Poor fella. He died that very year in the gas chamber, just 2 days before Christmas.
Sounds like an awful mess.
No, no, he never did confess. No, sir, right up to the very end, he said he never done it. Said he used black magic to call up some sort of imp, you know, to help him out and be a better bowler and all. And then he said things just got out of hand, and this imp just started killing everything in sight.
That is really the most stupid damn story I've ever heard.
No, it wasn't a bird, it was an imp. An imp, you see.
Now, listen, I want you to wait here. You lock the door and listen for us, please.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you. This dang thing's going on the blink again.
Here, I said you wait here, lock the door, and listen for us.
It still ain't working. I tell you what I better do. I think I better wait right here and lock the door and then listen for you.
Oh, great idea. Good idea. Yes. Come on.
So in addition to this, the two lines of his that are just all like all-timers, instant all-timers. One, that stuck tighter than a nun's cunt. And sucker's gonna be the size of a donkey's dick by daylight. Guess I better learn to scratch my balls with the other hand.
Yeah. That shit's too funny. Like I said, scene stealer through and through. The two of them kind of discussing the whole situation together was fucking genius. The film cuts to Lisa, who's still sitting around topless waiting for Keith to return. Unfortunately, Babs is the one that finds her, and she kills Lisa with a paddle.
That's a paddling.
As Babs is in the process of murdering Lisa, she's discovered and burned to death with a Molotov cocktail tossed by Calvin in an awesome flaming effect that probably cost at least 70% of the film's budget.
All of our money.
Spider and Calvin go back to tell the janitor, but find him dead as well. He's been hacked apart by Frankie, who, as you'll remember, was turned into the Bride of Frankenstein.
What a shame.
Yeah, right. Frankie chases them with an axe, which is probably the most awkward scene in the whole movie. It's kind of like one of those like Benny Hill
absolutely.
Types of things. If you just play,
I think if they had the music rights for it, they probably would have thrown that in there.
Yeah, right. With an axe until Spider gains the upper hand and decapitates her. The power of her death sends her severed head flying into the doors, breaking the magic binding them and knocking them wide open. Calvin heads outside to start up the car and is attacked by the last remaining demon, Rhonda, from the back seat, complete with meta commentary about how you should always check the back seat.
Jesus. So all of these little meta commentaries are one-liners that cut back to Uncle Impy.
Yeah. It's fucking great. We really haven't done a good job capturing the genius of the one-liners that Impy has throughout this film.
Genius?
Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and throw it out there.
You're going to go with that one? That's going to be your word of choice? Okay.
Yeah. Yep. Because they're... How about priceless? Yes. I like that more.
All right.
Because there's really nothing else like this film.
And
in the face of the earth.
And it didn't cost much.
You know, it didn't. It really didn't. Just to show that some of the best things come from meager backgrounds.
Man, you're hyping this one up. All right.
While this is going on, Spider successfully manages to capture Uncle Impy in a box during all the commotion. Calvin struggles to get control of the car while he's being attacked. And in the scene that's probably cost the rest of the film's budget, ends up sending the car flying over a ramp, doing a spin, and crashing it upside down. Calvin apparently survives this, and Rhonda is killed from the crash. In the morning, Spider drives Calvin to her house and on her motorcycle, while Uncle Impy is still trapped in the box at the curb, asking somebody to let him out.
Spider's going to turn Calvin into a man.
Yeah, right? This film is kind of, it's a lot unlike anything else we've covered so far on this cast. Marks one of the first ones that we've done where the nudity and the sleaze greatly outweigh the on-screen carnage. With the amount of love that there is still to this day for films like these, why do you think sleazier movies, or at least more sexually charged exploitation content, isn't released as frequently these days? It just seems like there's a lot more when films try to emulate the 80s, it's more just focusing on the practical effects, and
yeah,
the gore,
yeah,
rather than the sleaze and the bare bodies.
Well, I think there is still plenty of this.
Yeah,
It is all straight to VOD.
You think?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you're not going to see a movie like this ever hit theaters.
Well, to be fair, this one didn't really
hit
theaters.
So, I mean, there is plenty of stuff that comes out like this that's low budget and ends up straight on VOD. Usually, it shows its low budget much more than this movie
than does. This does, yeah. I think that's kind of the thing, right? Is like, back when these kinds of films were coming out in like the golden era of this type of stuff, the late 70s, early 80s, none of them felt like low budget films. Like, they definitely were, but when you're watching them nowadays, you could put them alongside some of their bigger, but like, they definitely don't match up to the likes of like the superstars, you know, the big, huge right. budget productions that came out from this time. Like, you can't put this next to Indiana Jones and say it's still,
no.
that it's like the same level of quality.
Well, I mean, another thing though is, you know, the sleaze stuff's still around, but you tend to find it more in comedies. They don't really play it so much in the horror genre anymore.
Yeah.
But like American Pie, for example, had just as much nudity as this does.
Did it?
I don't know. It's been the first one did. Like that whole opening, that whole first sequence with Jim and the foreign exchange student.
Oh,
where
right.
she's
like
laying on his bed naked.
Yeah.
Is that whole sequence is just as long as all the stuff with Keith.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
But it's just played up as a for laughs more than anything else. Stuff like this, I think, in as far as genre films go, the stuff that hits VOD directly, I feel like all the ones that we've seen and anything that we've like talked about that has this kind of nudity in it definitely tends to go more of the like gruesome exploitation route than just like comedy,
it's always
horror
like,
stuff.
It's always like a victim is stripped naked and then they're like slowly tortured or something.
Yeah, it's never anything that's kind of like a horror comedy kind of stuff. I also think, though, that at the end of the day, we're still a bunch of cowardly people afraid to talk about the best dragon dildo you can find in public. whereas, like, our generation specifically came of age with just a bunch of giant endless wars and death tolls constantly streaming across our TVs. And I think that if battles were fought with giant dildos as swords instead of guns, we'd be having a completely different conversation about why is the violence in this movie mostly done off screen, but, you know, tits and bush everywhere you can find it.
Yeah. I just think it's so funny because, like, stuff like this so rarely hits the mainstream nowadays. But when it does, it always ends up being, like, something that's pretty well received. For instance, like, think back on, remember Saints Row 3?
Yeah.
Like, you could beat people to death with a giant purple dildo.
Yeah, it was awesome.
They had, like, the sexuality meters that made your junk, like, the size of a donkey and the boobs, like, the size of, like,
that's
I don't know,
wonderful.
Kentucky. Like, stuff like this, I think, takes a lot more balls to be made now. And you have to do it. When you do it, you have to embrace it.
I think part of it, though, we've lost the ability to, like, ramp up that cheese factor.
Yeah.
And so I think most of the directors and even a lot of, like, the lower the low-budget indie guys and gals tend to kind of lean hard into one direction or the other.
You mean, like, too cheesy or...
No, just, like, if you've got, like, a comedy exploitation horror film, I think a lot of people either go too much horror, too much exploitation, too much comedy. There's not, like, that kind of cheese factor that ties everything together.
I gotcha.
I'd imagine
it's
difficult.
You get the spaghetti and the sauce and the meatballs. But you don't get the Parmesan at the top, is that what you're saying?
No Parmesans.
Okay.
And I imagine it's got to be a difficult thing to do. Because the problem is, if you go too far, it's just like, what the fuck? Why am I watching this? This is so dumb.
Yeah, it's a fine line,
whereas,
right?
Like, this is stupid as fuck, but it's fun.
Yeah. It's one of those, like... that's part of the reason that I think I'm enjoying doing films this much, as much as I am.
Yeah.
It's just because all of these movies, they really know how to kind of, like, toe the line. Because, like, if this just stepped 1 foot more into cheesy territory, it would be genuinely awful.
Yeah.
And if it stepped one more, if it tried to be a little more serious than it actually is, then it would be genuinely awful.
Yeah. But it hit that right note.
It walks that like fine line. It's hard to do. And I wonder if maybe we're losing a bit of our sense of humor as we go on, especially like in terms of like the horror realm.
Mm. I just think it's difficult.
Maybe.
I think it is genuinely difficult.
You think without like people like Roger Corman and stuff to kind of mold new talent?
Yeah, because I think a lot of the well-known directors now are established within their subgenres, and it's even comedy horror movies tend to not have this kind of level of like cheesiness to it.
Yeah.
Like Tucker and Dale, Cabin in the Woods, stuff like that. Like, they're funny, but they're not cheesy funny.
Yeah. Like, you're right. They're more like punchline funny.
Yeah.
Not like suffering as a result of like the situation, or cheesy as a result of the situation and everything that's going on. Yeah. I also think it takes like a certain type of cast. Mm-hmm. I think you have to have like this is one of those films where everything came together so perfectly for it. If you had different cast members that maybe weren't willing to do the same things.
Deep Murder.
Yeah, that's a good example of it, actually. There's a lot of fucking nonsense in that.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of the hijinks kind of stuff.
Yeah. No, I would agree. It's actually interesting that you bring that up, because
I think that's one of those that leaned too hard into the whole cheese aspect.
Okay.
But I appreciate the shot they took.
I would like to see more shots come back.
Yeah.
And give it a shot. Like, you do have stuff, though, that does it. Like, Dude Bro Party Massacre. That was pretty good.
Yeah.
But once again, that's one that leans more into, like, it's cheesy as hell, but it leans more into, like, the comedy and the gore. Mm-hmm. You don't get as much as the sleaze.
Yeah.
There are parts that are sleazy, but it's not, like, quite on the level of something like this.
Yeah. Which I think is fine, because, I mean, this one didn't have that much of the gore.
Yeah,
like, that's true. I don't think you have to have, like, a perfect balance of all three. I think tying it together, though, with just, like, that real just heavy coating of that nice, nice Parmesan, that's really what does the trick.
Yeah, and I mean, there have been other attempts. Gutter Balls, I think, is what it was called. I didn't like that one. Didn't resonate with me. I thought it was a little too mean-spirited. I watched the entire thing, but is that the movie? Yeah, Gutter Balls. It was just, it was too mean-spirited, I thought. But it tried to do something along the lines of this.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe you're right. Maybe it's just too hard. But out there in the ether exists the perfect trifecta.
I think so.
Somewhere. We have to discover it one of these days. Sam, you got any final points about this movie?
How do you feel about the 80s B-movie Scream Queens compared to the ones that became, like, the A-listers? Like, a Jamie Lee Curtis or...
You're talking about, like, Quigley versus Jamie Lee or something like that? So, like, I don't know. It's interesting. And this is a conversation that I would have liked to have with Alex here. It's... I don't know... Like, for instance, when I think
Scream... Jamie Lee did get naked, but I think... I think the first time she got naked in a role was not a horror movie.
Yeah, it was an action film.
Yeah.
I want to say it's different. Like, there's the A-list tier of Scream Queens, which are the ones that you immediately think of.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then there's the B-list tier, which I would lump Quigley in. Where you discover her once you start digging a little deeper into the horror films and realize how prominent she was. And I'd say there's actually a tier even underneath her.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Quigley's definitely firmly in that B-list tier. Some of the other Scream Queens that are in this film I would put more on the C-list tier.
Yeah.
Because they started veering off more into doing borderline softcore porn.
Right.
Rather than... pure horror stuff.
Yeah.
Which there's nothing wrong with. They just...
If only
were
they had,
in both worlds.
If only they had the dragon dildos then.
So yeah, I think it's like, it's an interesting thing. Like, I also think it's a question to kind of ask our listeners as well. It's like, what do you think of when you think Scream Queen? Do you think the A-list celebrities? Do you think the low-budget B-list horror films? Like, what comes to your mind first, and how do you differentiate them?
Yeah. I feel like we've done enough Scream Queen movies where I think we need to start putting together a list.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree. But we've got to come up with clear and concise guidelines for as to why.
Yeah.
And I think that's where it becomes hard, right? Like,
I mean, even without that, I would still settle just for like favorites in order. But I do think if we did with Scream Queens kind of what Alex did with her zombie guide.
That, it could be genius.
Yeah.
It could be genius. What are we rating this out of?
Donkey dick hands?
That one. How about
gutterball heads?
How about skimpy impies?
Skimpy impies.
How many skimpy impies are we giving this?
I'm gonna give this 3.25 skimpy impies.
3.25?
And
that's,
I think,
pretty good.
I think Alex said she was giving it a 3.
Yeah, she said she would have given it a 3 if she was here.
3 skimpy impies?
I would put this... It's funny. I would put this at a 2.75.
Okay.
So that gives us 9 total divided by 3 is 3?
Yeah.
Look at that.
Look at that. three skimpy impies.
3 skimpy impies. It's honestly, I think it's worth your time. If you like cheesy films, once again, the same thing that I said at the end of Tammy and the T-Rex. If you enjoy cheesy films, this is actually a pretty good one. I do think it's funny.
I don't give a shit. I know that you gave Tammy and the T-Rex a 5 for your nostalgia factor.
Mm-hmm.
This is a better movie.
No.
Yes.
No.
You know why? Because it wasn't hacked up by a bunch of unknown faceless people and then released in 2 different formats. Which had to be put together by like foreign cuts pulled off of YouTube.
No. All right. That wraps things up. We've hit our quota of boobs for the week. Actually, no, I don't think that's possible.
Sounds like you need a pad one.
Yeah, now that we... Right, I've been naughty. Now that we've just started dipping our toes into sleaze, what's on the books for next week? Basket case.
Yeah.
What happens when you take a little fleshy thing and put it in a basket? Lots of shit.
You get a case.
Excited to cover that one. I know that's a fan favorite for a lot of people.
Yeah.
It's going to be a good one. A good way to do a third week. Hopefully Alex will survives. Be a zombie with us next week.
Yeah, she survives this whatever she's got.
Yeah, and then we'll be reunited one last time. Because you're gone the last week, right?
I am gone the last week of the month.
I'm so sad.
Where you guys are going to be doing one of my favorite B-horror movies.
I'm so sad. I'm so sad.
That's all right. I've watched it. I will watch it in solidarity again. Because it's actually...
How will I live without you?
It's been a while since I've seen that killer tire.
It has been a while. Yeah. Rupper's a good one, dude. I'm excited to cover that. All right, you can follow us on social media, Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, all at Terran Podnito. You can follow us individually, too, on Palmer at Sturmsworth. Given how raunchy this week's content is, you'll probably find me looking at boobs. Sam?
I'm Sam at Sam Heaves. Doesn't really matter the content. I'm always looking at boobs.
And you can follow Alex at A-Looters.
Where she's always talking about her boobs.
Or, yes, where she's... No wonder we follow Alex. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back next week with more of what you've come to know and love from us. And as always,
keep it creepy.
Holy shit, coming from Sam.
I don't
Sam,
do it as well.
Like,
I don't do it as well as Alex.
Yeah.
That's a paddling. Thank you.